Okay, hi, we're going to get started. Welcome and thank you for joining us this Friday morning. We hope everyone is well. And I am now going to turn it over to Dean Tomaselli.
Thank you, Pam. And good morning, everybody, and welcome to our next in the series of conversations about the COVID-19 pandemic. What I'd like to start off with is some interesting work that has been done by the state of New York testing randomly patients in the state of New York, about 3,000. It was discovered that about 20% of us who live in New York City have antibodies to the COVID-19 virus. This is perhaps a little bit surprising, and it's a little bit variable in different parts of the state. However, I think it's going to help us and inform us on how we get things restarted when we're ready to do that. So, interestingly, New York City about 20% on Long Island, and in Westchester, it's just a little under 15% of the population's been infected, presumably. And in the rest of the state, upstate New York, outside the Hudson Valley, it's only about 3.5%. So, interesting. We are still challenged here in the Bronx by COVID-19. We still have just under 1,500 patients with the virus in our health system. This actually has increased from zero patients in the beginning of March. It is down from the peak of about 2,000 and steadily but slowly is coming down. This really does take an enormous toll on healthcare providers, on our students, and on our scientists. And we're delighted today to have Dr. Jonathan Alpert and Dr. Sandra Pimentel to talk about that psychological toll. And I'll introduce them formally in just a minute or two. But I did want to give you a little bit of an update on what's going on scientifically here at Einstein and Montefiore. We have several clinical trials that are ongoing. Dr. Barry Zingman is leading the remdesivir trial. This is a drug that attacks the virus, and it's now in its second phase, and we've enrolled just about 100 patients in this study. We also target the immune system of the patient because one of the responses to infection is for the immune system to be hyperactive and to actually cause problems if it's too active. And Dr. Michelle Gong in the ICU is using an antibody to attack to tamp down the immune response in patients who've got the most serious form of this disease called sarilumab, and that's enrolled about 100 patients as well. We have a number of other antibody studies that are trying to modify the immune response to the virus, including Dr. Seetham Raju's monoclonal antibody study looking at another receptor that's involved in inflammation in the lung. The one study that I think is hopefully going to show some promise is one led by Dr. Lizanne Porosky and Johanna Daly. And this is, I'm sure you've heard about this, the use of what's called convalescent plasma. That is somebody who's had the infection, who's recovered, who now has antibodies in their blood. We use those antibodies in their blood to actually treat people with the disease. So this is, a strategy that's been used for many, many years for many different types of diseases. And really requires only that you identify somebody who's had the disease and has recovered. So again, perhaps a lot of promise there. Our basic researchers have also been very active. Dr. Kartik Chandran has created what we call a pseudovirus that expresses the spike protein. I'm sure you've seen the images of the SARS virus. It's like a ball with spikes on it, and those spikes are the spike proteins. They are important for at least two reasons. One, they are the protein that the virus uses to infect cells. And two, they are typically the protein to which an antibody is made that can neutralize the virus. So Kartik's generated a modified virus that could be used to create a better antibody test and also to develop vaccines. Dr. Steve Almo, in collaboration with Dr. Chandran, has generated a high-resolution molecular structure of this spike protein. That's really important because it tells us and gives us some insight into how that protein works. Again, that's going to make for better antibody tests and going to make for more well-defined therapeutics for the virus. Dr. Jonathan Lai, in collaboration with Dr. Porosky and Dr. Daly, are taking this convalescent blood, blood from patients who've actually survived, and not only looking at plasma, but also trying to isolate cells, particularly the immune cells that are the antibody factories. So you can actually create or have those cells generate antibodies that might be effective against the virus. Dr. Lai, Dr. Greeley, and Dr. Chandran are also trying to study the genetics of the virus itself. Here in the Bronx, patients tend to be pretty severely affected, and we don't know whether or not that has to do with something, pre-existing conditions in the patients who get infected, or perhaps a different strain of this virus that's a little bit more vicious here compared to other places in the country. And finally, Dr. Rick Kitsis, who's the director of the Wilf Center for Cardiovascular Research, is actually looking at the receptor to which the spike protein binds in human cells. And this is called the ACE2 receptor. The reason this is important is many people who have cardiovascular disease take drugs that modify this receptor, and we don't know whether or not those are protective drugs or those are drugs that might make people more susceptible to more severe infection. So lots going on at Einstein. And without further ado, let me introduce our two speakers today who are going to talk about the toll that this pandemic is taking on workers at all levels in our health system. We have with us today Dr. Jonathan Alpert, who's our psychiatrist in chief and is the Dorothy and Marty Silverman University Professor and the chair of the Department of Psychiatry. We're also delighted to have Dr. Sandra Pimentel, who's the chief child and adolescent psychology, and she's the director of the Anxiety and Mood Program and Child Outpatient Psychiatry Department. So, Jonathan and Sandra, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Dean Tomaselli. It's a great privilege to join you and Dr. Pimentel to talk about mental health. And it's particularly timely, and I appreciate the value that you place, Dean Tomaselli, on the mental health of all of our basic scientists and healthcare workers and our communities that we serve. When we've speak about a second wave of COVID-19, what most of us think about is the wave that some infectious disease specialists have spoken about, the possibility in the fall or in the winter that we'll see a resurgence of COVID-19. And certainly we all are very concerned about that and preparing for that possibility and hoping to mitigate against that possibility by being very thoughtful about not letting down our guard and the precautions that we as a society have been taking and as a medical center have been taking. But we as mental health professionals, Dr. Pimentel and myself, for example, as Dr. Pimentel is a psychologist, I'm a psychiatrist. We as mental health professionals, when we think about a second wave of COVID-19, we're thinking about something different, which is the emotional toll that typically follows a major disaster. And whether that disaster is 9/11 or Hurricane Sandy, or is a pandemic, what we've learned over the years is that after the initial physical and general medical toll of a major disaster, there's an emotional toll. And the emotional toll and the footprint of the emotional toll tends to be even greater than the physical toll. So many people who are not directly affected, for example, by COVID-19, are indirectly affected in terms of their mental health. They're indirectly affected by virtue of its economic impact on their family lives. They're impacted by social isolation. They're impacted by losses that they might have experienced or anxieties that they might have experienced about loved ones. And so that we are seeing and we're anticipating that as the number of COVID cases in the New York City area fortunately peaks and has gradually been coming down, that we're going to see a rise in people coming forward who need help with their mental health. I wanted to mention first, before Dr. Pimentel talks to us, generally about health and resilience, as well as about families and children. I know many of you are concerned about healthcare workers and what we are doing at Einstein as a system to support them, because we do know that the experience of taking care of very, very sick people in a very short period of time, the numbers ramped up massively in a way that most of us alive have never seen in our medical careers, and the number of losses in a short time were greater and will continue to be greater for some time than most of us have ever seen in our medical careers. So we wanted to be as active as possible as a system in supporting our healthcare workers. So I'll just mention briefly some of the things that we've done, as I know that many of you listening have expressed interest about the health of our workers. One has to do with setting up support centers. Those are physical centers at each of the campuses. So at the Einstein Weiler Hospital, at Wakefield, at Moses Campus, at the Children's Hospital, CHAM. We've set up physical spaces where at each site there's a volunteer mental health person. There are refreshments. There are massage chairs. There's often music. But it's a place of respite. People can talk to the volunteers who are there if they want to talk. But some people come in just for 5 or 10 minutes before going back to their clinical units or before going home just to steady themselves. And so those are the support centers. The other is an emotional support phone line for Montefiore Einstein healthcare workers that's been available from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., 7 days a week for some weeks now. And so that anyone in distress, whether it's somebody who works in maintenance or somebody who works in the ICU, can call anytime during those hours. And on the other end, have a psychologist or a psychiatrist who takes their call and spends as much time as necessary helping them. A subset of people need more formal mental health evaluation and treatment, and so we've set up a clinic that we call the SMART Clinic, and a component of that called the SMART Fam Clinic, which is more of a family parenting component. But for any Montefiore Einstein employees who are having COVID-related stress problems and require short-term treatment, the SMART Clinic is now set up and expediting referrals so people can get in right away to see a psychologist or psychiatrist for treatment. And then finally, one of the most challenging issues with frontline providers is the tendency for them to be either too stoic and or too overextended to actually seek out any of these other kinds of support and care. And so with our colleagues in the Department of Medicine, we came up with the idea of creating a buddy system, which we call the Montefiore Emotional Support Allies. And the allies are basically 120 mental health professionals like myself and like Dr. Pimentel. And we're paired up with over 2,000 frontline clinicians who might be respiratory therapists, nurses, physicians, assistants. They might be house officers, that is residents or interns, or they may be experienced attending physicians, but we're paired up with a roster of frontline clinicians, each one of us, you know, perhaps with about 20 to 30 frontline clinicians who we reach out to initially by email. And unless they opt out, which very few people have opted out from, we stay in touch with them and we let them know it's basically just one other form of human connection. And many people say they have supportive teams, they might have supportive families, but that it's been very good to be able to talk about the experiences they've had on the wards during this unprecedented period of time with somebody who both has a mental health background and can be gently helpful in those respects and can steer them to resources that might be helpful, but also is not on their team and not in their family. They often worry about scaring their families by describing some of the experiences they've had, and they don't want to feel that their teams feel that they're whining about experiences they've had, but they've had pretty life-changing experiences on the wards, as you can imagine. And many of them have expressed a lot of gratitude to have an ally or a buddy who they're paired up with, who's really following them through in the previous weeks and in the many weeks ahead during this most challenging time. So I just wanted to outline those pillars of support that we've tried to put in place, and thank you all for your concern about healthcare workers throughout the Einstein-Montefiore system. And now I'll turn it over to Dr. Pimentel, who I often turn to for advice on health and resilience, as well as parenting. And so I'm so glad that she is on our call.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alpert, and thank you, Dean Tomaselli, and for everyone listening. It's really an honor and a joy to be with you all on this Friday morning. And thank you for the attention being paid to mental health in these sort of very trying times. As Dr. Alpert said, there's a lot going on right now, and what we know from the field of disaster psychiatry in particular is that there will be more to come. I'm sort of glad to speak to you all on what has been sort of deemed the optimistic side of the risk pathology framework, which is resilience. And a lot of what Dr. Alpert just described about some of the systems we've tried to put in place for our healthcare workers are built on some of these foundational aspects of resilience. And I'm going to share with you just a little bit on, I'm a little bit of a nerd in this kind of way, where I like to share a little bit of the background about resilience. And one of the myths of resilience is that a person is either resilient or not. And what we know from a fairly robust literature in resilience on trauma and disasters and the Holocaust and other sort of periods of adversity is that resilience is much more of a pattern and a process that develops and that we can develop. And some of the early work and some of the seminal work on resilience was actually done in children who were in extremely stressful backgrounds, extreme poverty, families, having parents with significant mental illness and unpredictability. And the good news is that there are protective factors that go along with turning out okay. Resilience refers to, positive adaptation despite significant life adversity and perhaps even because of it. And so by definition, we need adversity to build our resilience. And what we know from sort of decades of research is that there are certain factors, protective factors, that can go along with and that we can build for protecting us, protecting kids, protecting families from some of these sort of negative outcomes, potential negative outcomes. And I want to talk to you a little bit about those. I'll give a little bit of an overview, and I know there are some questions that will be coming in, and I want to make sure we have enough time for those. But if we think about resilience as a pattern, what we know, and I'll start with kids, that's kids and teens, that's what's near and dear to me, but it applies to all of us, really. Is that, one of the most protective factors for children in their adjustment is effective parenting. And I say effective parenting, that's not perfect parenting, and certainly not during a pandemic perfect. I know there's so much pressure and stress on families and worry from parents and grandparents about, how kids will turn out and not feeling like there's a lot of chaos in the home. And, my message there is that it's okay. Effective parenting means sort of trying to establish routines, rituals, and rules. And in times of uncertainty, if we are able to provide routines, rituals, and rules, that sort of counts as sort of effective parenting and sort of stabilizing the family system. The other thing we know from the literature, a very robust literature, is in children, is that if parents can manage their own stress and can be attuned to their own mental health needs as the adults, and can sort of not only find ways of coping and using their own resiliency strategies, that has downstream effects for kids and child adjustment. So it's extremely important. The old, put the mask on yourself in the airplane analogy is very, very true. And so if we can manage and help to manage parent stress and stress levels, that's a very effective strategy, both for the parent and for children and others in the family. So, one of the main researchers in the field of child resilience in particular is Ann Mastin, and she has a quote that I really love, and essentially it's resilience arises from ordinary magic. And what that means is that we have a great capacity to adapt And when we rely on those, you know, mechanisms of adaptation, and when we rely on those particular factors, you know, resilience will sort of fall into place and we can develop those. And so when we look at what does that mean? What does that mean in terms of the individual, on the individual level? What are some characteristics that we can start to take a look at to build some of that resiliency? We know that how we think about the world, sort of our cognitive, you know, flexibility, sense of humor, making meaning in the world, those are extremely important for finding resilience. There's a great piece, I don't know if you guys saw it, if you didn't take a look, it was in the New York Times, it was about tragic optimism. And that is, it was a nice, very nice summary of some of the research that looks at, you know, if we are able to find and make meaning. Some of this research was done post 9/11. They have found similar findings with heart attack survivors, that if we are able to make meaning out of some adversity or out of some event, we are much more likely to have better outcomes in it. So, you know, our cognitive abilities and how we think and how we perceive the world are extremely important in our resilience building. Other characteristics, of course, physiologic, physical, emotional. So are you getting, you know, stuff that you already know, exercise, opportunity to, you know, get good sleep, managing sleep. Sleep is a big issue and has been a big issue during this pandemic because schedules are out of whack. It's hard to know what day it is sometimes if we don't have a particular schedule or different work schedules, working from home, quote unquote. Things like that. So if there's a way to protect and get back to a regular sleep schedule, emotion regulation skills. So how do you manage strong feelings? How do you cope with when you are sad or anxious? Do you have strategies like deep breathing or mindfulness strategies or things like that that you can incorporate into your day? And on the child side, you know, parents sometimes tell me that they are worried. Grandparents, they tell me they're worried about showing strong feelings in front of their kids. And the good news is that it's okay to show your feelings within limits, depending on the age of your child. And the more important thing is to demonstrate with them how you are coping and how you're problem solving, so that then you can be a model for them. One, that it's okay to have feelings and that it's okay to even have strong feelings during a very, very scary thing. And, you know, knowing that one of the strongest things that we can teach kids is to be able to tolerate uncertainty. And we certainly know that there's a lot of uncertainty to go around, and being flexible teaching them sort of that flexibility can be helpful, especially with managing emotions. I mentioned a little bit about the family stuff and parenting and effective parenting. The other piece and catching irritability and hostility in parenting is another important factor to be mindful of, and sort of just in terms of the family aspect of it. And then we know that there are some community elements that build and contribute to resilience. So, you know, sense of community. One of the, I think, the silver linings in much of this is that we are seeing how interconnected we all are, and reminding ourselves of that and finding and seeking some of that out, the collective experience, the collective humanity of all of this, looking to community and how communities have come together. Those are markers of resilience. So looking at these different levels, that you can see how resilience is this multi-level developmental process rather than either you're resilient or not. And I think there's a lot of good news in there. I also tend to try to find the tragic optimism in all of this. And so trying to find some of those and create and cultivate, and those are all muscles that we can, you know, proverbially exercise. The other piece to be very mindful of is sort of the social aspects of resilience. And again, in that community and in that collective, one of the most important things is finding social support. Who's your team? And teaching kids, who's your team? Who's on your team? It doesn't have to be a huge team, but it can be a team. And you'll see that some of the supports that Dr. Alpert mentioned are built in that, especially, you know, if we think about our healthcare workers, they're, you know, within the groups, whether it's nursing groups or respiratory therapists or some of our engineering folks, you know, how do they come together as a team to deal with some of these issues and understand it in ways that they have their team? So there may be a work team. There may be, you know, who's on your team in your family? Is it, you know, grandma, grandpa, cousin, aunt or uncle? Teaching kids to think about who's on their team, who can they reach out to if they want to talk to someone? Who's on your team? Who are your supports that you're going to reach out to? And so, you know, finding and building that and being explicit and writing it down and helping kids to write it down, for example, those are all important aspects of resilience. see. I think I can stop there. I can go on and on, but I'll stop here so that we can make sure to field questions.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. That was incredibly helpful. So there are a few questions, and perhaps we can have you both address these. So and what are the effective ways to practice kind of mindfulness, gratitude, and resilience, particularly through the lens of, we don't know when the back end of this is going to be. We don't know when we're going to, in quotes, get back to normal. Are there specific strategies that we as healthcare providers, that the population can use without really having a definite time when we know we're going to be kind of in a more normal situation? And I'll open it to both of you to address that.
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in, Dr. Albert, and then I think that's such a great question. I think we need to practice, relentless self-care and family care, particularly in this time. Some of it is that we are tolerating, as I mentioned before, and as you mentioned, Dean Tomaselli, there's a lot of uncertainty. And so being able to focus on what we can control and what we are certain of is, today's Friday, and we can manage today's schedule. Or if you're going into the weekend, what is your weekend schedule going to look like? And when will you schedule that mindfulness exercise? What are some specific strategies? The great thing about mindfulness is that we can practice it in terms of, there's a 1 minute mindfulness exercise that, you can focus on your breath. The core of mindfulness is being able to pay attention in the present moment without judgment. Now, the present moment doesn't require needing to know what's going to happen next week. And so if we can get ourselves to focus on our breath or how our feet feel on the floor, on the ground, or how our bodies feel in a chair, that's a mindfulness exercise. One of the exercises I do with kids who have a lot of test anxiety is that we have them hold the pen and they just practice and observe and describe skill, just describing the pen, the feel of the pen in their hand, what they see, what they feel. And it's just getting them to focus in the present, which is, again, an exercise in sort of strengthening the brain. So, there are also mindfulness meditations that are 15 minutes or 20 minutes. There are wonderful apps that I'm happy to, forward to you if you want to forward around to everyone that have some great mindfulness exercises. But you don't need the 20 minutes. It's much more about carving out that minute, that 3 minutes, that 5 minutes for mindfulness. And on the topic of gratitude, I think that is one of the most important ones in these times. We talked a little bit about, meaning making. And I think what we're seeing a lot of, thankfully, is folks trying to find the joy and trying to find, gratitude, because I think there's so much to be grateful for. And I think people are realizing that. And gratitude and working on gratitude are skills as well. And whether for ourselves or kids or grandkids, that's something that we can teach. I have a post-it note on my bedside table that I've had for a couple of years now. And that's my reminder to myself to say, okay, what was I grateful for today before I go to bed? I used to, as an exercise, it was assigned to me as a graduate student, I won't say how long ago, and that we had to actually write it down. And now I don't need to write it down. The post-it note is the reminder. And that's an exercise that we can create with kids. You can do a gratitude journal if you wanted to do something more, more specific. There are some great things online that are, good news dashboards that have, there's a lot of, by the way, shut off the news. That's the other resilience strategy. You control the messaging of what comes into your house. So shut off the news. Don't let kids watch the news. Limit your time on social media. Hopefully you've gotten that message before. But if you are going to put it on, look for the good news. Find the joy. Look for the things to be grateful for, especially things going on locally, because those tend to have more meaning, for us because they're familiar and finding things that are resonating with our values and thinking about ways to be thankful for, there's a nurse, I heard about a nurse who is sleeping in her car in the driveway so she doesn't infect her elderly parents. And she said in this news piece, she said, thank goodness I have a car. And I was so struck by that, and so I think finding ways to cultivate and exercise that particular skill within ourselves. And then, of course, if we have kids and, I have a niece who's a nurse and I talk to her all the time. And so if we have people, younger people in our lives that we want to communicate that to, making sure that we do so expressly.
Great, John?
That's a wonderful answer. And I would say that, you know, expressing gratitude is not about denying negative feelings in any kind of way. But I think being able to understand that for many people, this has been about the most challenging period of time and most surreal and dislocating period of time they've lived through. But also to understand how much we're learning during this time, you know, not only learning about science and medicine, but learning about things that are meaningful to us personally, professionally, in our family lives, what we value. I one of the people that I'm paired with as an ally is a first year resident in medicine, an intern. So she's not even one full year out of medical school. And she said, you know, Dr. Alpert, this has been the scariest, hardest period of time ever in my life, and certainly during my medical career, but in any other time in my life, I've never seen so many losses. But I also think about, you know, how fortunate I am to be able to serve during a pandemic, and, you know, all of my training to be able to use that. And I think those kinds of messages to be able to, for us all to say, this has been, we've had to adjust to so much, we've missed out on graduations and weddings and celebrations of holidays, and we missed social interactions and the touch of other people. But we're living through a unique period of time, and we're learning so much about ourselves. So being able to harness whatever we can that we might be grateful for, I think doesn't mean in any way negating the all the negatives and the suffering that we're experiencing and seeing other people experience. But still being able to distill at the end of the day what we feel thankful for.
Right. So the other thing about this whole pandemic is it's incredibly isolating. Whether or not you're shut in, just the way we have to interact with one another, it becomes incredibly isolating. Human contact seems to be something we want to avoid rather than embrace. So are there strategies for children and for adults dealing with kind of the isolation that this pandemic is imposing upon us?
By all means, perhaps Dr. Pimentel would like to start with that, and I'd be glad to jump in.
Sure, and that's one of the things, certainly, you know, if you talk to teenagers, you know, that they're reporting, and we're seeing in a lot of the kids that we treat, a lot of isolation and loneliness and disconnectedness. And I think it related to what Dr. Alpert was saying, I think it is important to honor the losses, especially for kids. You know, school is not only academic. Whether they would admit it or not, there are benefits in terms of the social aspects, the structure and the scheduling, and even contacts with other adult mentors like teachers or the security guard or the office workers at the school who check in with kids. And so it's lots of relationships in ways in terms of, you know, kids and friendships, but also other meaningful adults. And, you know, I treat a teenager who is very dismayed about, you know, not being able to play softball with her team and with graduating seniors and things like that. So I think, you know, one of the sort of starting points is honoring that loss and validating for ourselves that this is hard. It's loss of that contact, loss of that regularity. And then being able to find and be creative and relentlessly so, that's a word I use often, about, you know, prioritizing social connection, you know, despite the physical distancing and despite the importance, and especially for kids, helping them understand, and especially teenagers, helping them understand the need for the self-quarantining. There was just a rapid review that came out in The Lancet, I think it came out a couple of days ago, and I was happy to have caught it, that looked at the effects of quarantining. And, you know, what they found is that there were fewer negative impacts, you know, they looked at the psychological impacts of quarantine, you know, Ebola and SARS and whatnot. And they found that there's sort of fewer negative impacts if people understood that they were making an altruistic choice. And, you know, the reasons for our isolation and the reasons for sort of staying at home and not doing things as ordinarily, especially for kids, and helping them understand that there was some collective and greater good and public health component to it. And if we could encourage that, that diminishes some of the negative psychological effects. In the shorter term, in addition to that, is being creative about, you know, I know that we're all Zoomed out and FaceTimed out, and finding and scheduling ways to either have phone calls or, you know, writing letters. I know that we started a program here where we have kids as pen pals to some of our frontline healthcare workers, and, you know, being creative about how we connect. You know, some kids painted, you know, I don't know if they were called happy rocks or something, or where they were sort of offered to people. I think they're the nice side and the resilient side is that there's opportunity for creativity in how we connect. And I do think, you know, keeping an eye on, you know, teenagers, for example, there's some normal, in quotes, you can't see it, but I'm making quotes, you know, this is sort of teenagers may be withdrawing or going into their room or something like that, and keeping an eye on them, or emerging adults even, and keeping an eye on them that they are still, if they're doing that, which in part is sort of normative, also maintaining connection, being a part of the family. If they're not, you know, maybe finding and seeking some help.
Great, John.
Great. No, I fully agree. I think those are excellent insights.
So perhaps one final thing. Of course, this pandemic is occurring in a context, and the context is we still have lots of mental illness and substance abuse that's ongoing in our community. How is this, do you think, affecting kind of the other things that you two have to kind of deal with in your regular practices?
Right, it's a great question. So, you know, certainly superimposed upon the baseline of significant mental illness and addiction that we're always dealing with, are now additional adversities, certainly economic uncertainty for many people. There's been an increase in domestic violence, probably for a variety of reasons. There's certainly trauma and grief that, as usual, is disproportionate, that it has disproportionately affected, losses have disproportionately affected families often least able to cope with those losses. So there's certainly an upsurge of a need for that. Some of the remarkable silver linings and blessings of this period has been the rapid acceleration of the use of telehealth, so that we've been able to maintain connection with people who do have serious mental illness and addiction. Some people need to come in person, and there's just not a way around that. But many of the people that we treat, even people with very severe mental illness or addiction problems, can be treated through telehealth. And we've seen another silver lining is an uptick in people presenting themselves for treatment of opioid use disorders, in part because the supply chain of drugs on the street, you know, has been interrupted, just like the supply chain of so many other things. And so people who have been contemplating the possibility of getting treatment, this has really catalyzed those efforts where they've come in and said, well, I finally decided that I need to tackle this problem. And we hope that for some of them, you know, as they get on methadone and buprenorphine and other and psychotherapy, other kinds of treatments, certainly some of them will relapse without question, but we hope that for many of them, this will be the beginning of a more positive trajectory in their addiction. So there have been some silver linings, both telehealth and the fact of people presenting for addiction treatment who might not otherwise have had the same incentive to do that.
Thank you, Dr. Pimentel.
Yeah, I agree with everything Dr. Alpert just said. And interestingly, one of the things we've seen on the child side and the kid side is that our attendance of sessions via telehealth, and now we have video platform, you know, both telephonic and video platform, our attendance has gone up for many of our kids and families. So some of the, you know, traditional barriers, financial, getting to our clinic, having to use a MetroCard, childcare, things like that, have been, for better or worse, removed. And the ability to do telehealth has you know, removed those barriers and now allowed us to have almost more direct access to some of our kids and families.
Terrific. Conscious of the hour here, I do want to thank you both for joining us today. It's been very insightful, and I want to thank everybody on the phone for their support of Montefiore and Einstein and for attending today. And I hope everybody stays well as we move forward in this pandemic. And I do believe there's a light. It's a little bit dim, but there's a light at the end of this tunnel, and hopefully we're getting through it soon. So thank you, everybody, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dean Tomaselli.